Well, wonderful to be here with you, and lots of stories and rumors about how the Navigators got started. So I want to read extracts from two printed articles, and then we'll have the guy come on that was there, Lester Spencer, and straighten it out. You can pick out the mistakes. I often am asked, how do I compare the present Navigators with the early Navigators? Well, I don't like to make judgments. So I just say there's a lot of good material. Dig it out and decide for yourself. The book DOS, a lot of good material. But The Navigator by Bob Foster, good book. The one that came out for the 75th anniversary. It's about the first two presidents, the Navigators, and the news keeps up to date, the January-December issue of Mission Frontiers has a condensation of the tape Born to Reproduce. So this is real up-to-date information on it. Back in the early 30s, in the middle 30s, our intelligence knew the Japanese were building up no bases, knew it was bad news, what was coming off. But the nation was very pacifistic, and Congress was very slow to appropriate. So the Navy got so concerned, they offered 12 reporters a two-week tour of the Pacific to go around seeing how unprepared we were, how strong the Japanese were, hoping they would come home and stir up public opinion. One of the publishers who responded to the invitation was Walter Davenport. He was the political editor of Carter's Magazine, the most widely read magazine of the day, cost 5 cents. Sold on the street corners. That had a larger circulation probably than Time Magazine or any others today. So the Navy was very interested in what his first article would be, helping build up the defense. And we're kind of shocked when the first article he wrote came out entitled Onward Christian Soldiers. It says they pray as they work. They sung unto the Lord as they go down the sea. They rejoice with left hooks when men revile them. And they're just enlisted men in the United States Navy. Stephen Decatur turns in his grave. John Paul Jones rubs his hollow eyes. Farragut stops damning torpedoes. It's amazing. And a picture of Dawson Trotman and Cliff Burton in the lead article in that magazine. The principal person talked about is a guy named Orrin Bell. I'm going to read about him a little bit. But I was in Honolulu at the time. He rode the ship from San Francisco to Honolulu, and I met him after he got in. And one of the first things he said was, I had a wonderful opportunity to witness coming over. He said some civilian was on the ship. But, you know, he said, it kind of bothered me. He wrote down everything I said. And he never realized that he was being interviewed for an article. When it happened, it's just another opportunity to witness. So, Mr. Davenport describes his first evening aboard ship. I'll read part of it. His escort was a chief bosun mate. He said, we just grabbed Mr. Murphy's arm, interrupting him. Gobs, your gentlemen, we've just seen something. Four sailors, trim as new sloops, but with their faces set in green lines, were about to go over in a body. Under their arms, clamped tight to the ribs, they carried Bibles. Just before they descended into the cutter, one of them, a little taller than the rest, paused. We guess he was about 25 years old. He had a hawk face, wide shoulders, big hairy hands, and one glance told you it would be very bad judgment indeed to ask him to step out into the alley. His sharp, weathered face lifted toward this clean, cool sky that domed San Francisco Bay. His eyes closed, his lips moved, his companions bowed their heads. The silent prayer lasted but a moment, and then all four went over, stern, aloof, resolute. Navigators, explained Mr. Murphy, they're new too. We've got about 12 of them on the California, maybe 15, you can't tell. Today you've got 12, maybe 15. Tomorrow you've got maybe 18 or 20. They're always working on the wicked, converting sinners, holding revivals, praying with lost souls. Every ship in the fleet's got some. I don't know how many in all, and they ain't sin. I ain't saying that they've converted some of the officers of the fleet, but I ain't saying they ain't, too. I ain't saying it's a good thing, although religion never hurt any man, including a sailor. And I ain't saying it's bad, but there's a time for working. Trouble is, you can't tell when these navigators, when they're going to quit praying and work, although many times I've seen them do both at once. I will say, however, that there ain't a day passes that I don't say my prayers myself, and I ain't a navigator. I've seen a lot of changes in the Navy in 30 years, this being one of them. The fellow you've seen praying before he went over the side, he's the missionary. The missionary can pray, work, and give you a nice poke in the nose all at the same time. You ought to meet him. I'll fix it. Actually, he was a light heavyweight boxer in the fleet, champion. Mr. Murphy fixed it. On the following day, the California trudged heavily westward through the Pacific's long swells. We shook hands with missionary shipfitter Second Class Orrin Bell of Cooper, Texas. Mr. Bell is pure Texas, country Texas. He is wide-mouthed, and his short jaw is heavily muscled at the hinges. He's loose, rangy, slow-spoken, and his blue eyes were set for distance. One day a persistently abusive sinner called him a name that nobody had a right to put on anybody, and offering up a very brief prayer for forgiveness. He proceeded to beat the beholden out of the fellow. In no time at all, Mr. Bell's opponent was flat on his face, a very distressing sight indeed. Dropping his knees, Mr. Bell took his fallen foe in his arms, bound up his numerous wounds, and prayed. Then he toted his misguided shipmate to his bunk where he lay recovering while Mr. Bell did the chores for him in addition to his own. As a result, Mr. Bell has been offended, but seldom since, and has won, incidentally, quite a few converts to the navigators. Now here's the interesting part. Anybody ever asked you to explain the navigators? Before going into our conversations with Mr. Bell, it might be well to you what and who the navigators are. Ready for it? Mr. Bell, the missionary, insists that it isn't a religion in itself, nor is it a distinct denomination, having no organization as such. It isn't a cult, having no specific rites nor peculiar ceremony. Mr. Bell, a man of comprehensive simplicity, was unable to state a clear definition, but said that any church wherein was preached pure fundamentalism and wherein the Bible was accepted literally from the first word of Genesis to the last amen of Revelation of St. John the Divine. It was even conceivable, he said, that a Jew might be a navigator, although it would not be a simple matter, it being essential that a navigator be a Christian. We sparred a number of slow theological rounds with Missionary Bell, losing badly, before deciding to shut up and let him do the talking. He told us that about 10 or 12 years ago, Mr. Dawson Trotman, living then at the gate of the United States Naval Base at Long Beach, California, founded the Navigators. Mr. Trotman worked in a lumberyard. In his moments of leisure, he was accustomed to drink spirituous liquor, smoke much more than was good for him, and occasionally, when matters went from bad to worse, give tongue to a number of full-bodied oaths. All this is cheerily admitted. Lost my place here. By Mr. Trotman, who is now living in Los Angeles, an active worker in the Church of the Open Door. Mr. Trotman frequently gives testimony that, too, to indulging in those many social zowies that youth is prone to call fun. Like Paul, headed for Damascus, breathing out threatenings and slaughter against the disciples of the Lord, Mr. Trotman stopped all this in his own tracks, renounced old Satan, quit the lumberyard, and began redeeming sailors from sin. The Lord smiled upon his work from the beginning, starting with a new strength, a new faith, a worn Bible, and four sailors. Mr. Trotman is now the head of a way of life. Mr. Bell refuses to let us call it organization. That is followed by hundreds of blue jackets. In the beginning, there was but one shore station where navigators might get together for Bible reading, prayer, song, and testimony. It was Mr. Trotman's homely quarters in Longreach boarding house. But Mr. Trotman took to religion with the same headlong vigor that he had characterized his unregenerate life. Today, from Bremerton, Washington to San Diego, California, and on to Honolulu and Manila, the navigators wage an all-out war on Beelzebub, and the Lord has blessed their passion measure for measure. They have no real estate to call their own, but scores of churches and missions, all of them dedicated to vociferous evangelism and uncompromising fundamentalism. Call them brother. Well, then he goes on with a good interview with Orrin Bell. And then I don't know how much money he raised for the Navy at this article. But at the end of the week, Mr. Davenport met with Mr. Bell. He says, when we left Mr. Mercy, he had stopped fanning himself completely, recovered from his losing faith with the bright, polishing navigator. But just outside his quarters, we ran into second-class shipfitter Bell. Mr. Bell told us he was glad to have met us. He smiled serenely and shook hands. Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, he bade us, and thou shalt be saved. Good luck, mister. This article was written September, before, just 3 months before the war broke out at Pearl Harbor. So that's one view of the navigators. 2 weeks after Dawson Trotman's death, Time magazine had their religious article featuring him. And here's what they said. Memorizing the Bible was the key to conversion, as Mr. Trotman saw it. So he handed out scores of scriptures to youth groups he organized. One day in 1934, a mother asked him to look up her son, a sailor on a ship off Long Beach. Sitting in his old car by the waterfront, Trotman quoted the Bible to the boy until a policeman grew suspicious. A few minutes later, Trotman had talked the cop into joining him and the sailor in a session of prayer. The sailor said, I'd give my right arm if I could do what you just did. Dawson challenged him to try. It was the beginning of a movement that Trotman called the Navigators for its natural origins, nautical origins. For that sailor converted a friend with the technique he had learned from Dawson Trotman, and that convert in turn convinced another. Soon navigators were spread across the seven seas. At one point during the war, there were navigators in more than 1,000 U.S. Navy ships and stations, which fact has been checked. In all of its history, the navigators have never had more than 500 ships and stations. They did have probably 1,000 military addresses, because in the Army particularly, you know, you have many military addresses in. But that statement's been thrown around, I think probably printed in some of our literature, but it deserves a second look. Now, this doesn't have to do with the article, but if you haven't read this before, I think you'll find it interesting. In 1953, Trotman bought a large, luxurious ranch and turned it into a national headquarters and free vacation spot for navigators. That's a good place to stop, isn't it? Okay.
Jim, tell them what's underneath the picture. That Time magazine.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, well, after Collier's got the article, they wanted a picture. So they sent a professional photographer out to get a picture. And Dawson Trotman said, under one condition, that we'll get to read the article before it's published. So they agreed, but they didn't. Now, this is the posed picture that was taken by the professional photographers for Collier's magazine. But it's clearly a posed picture. I never saw Dawson Trotman sitting down like a desk like that in my life. So clearly posed, but it's the most widely used. Now, in the Collier's article, they got another picture where he's pointing his finger at a sailor, Cliff Burton, on there. Okay, I don't have a place to lay that, Susan. That's the reason I'm throwing it down here. Well, there are many errors in both the articles. But we have a 42-minute tape. I'm going to play a part of it, of Lester Spencer telling about when he first met Dawson Trotman and what happened after that. So, ready to roll.
The duck rushed down to the Kona field and sent a radiogram to me on the West Virginia. And that was something like this. Meet me at the dock at 4 o'clock. I'll be wearing a light coat, dark trousers, fast shoes, and soft drops. Now, he had given the name of Rittenhouse originally.
I'll sit on that.
That hasn't gotten any. So, about 8:30, I was cleaning up the vision of the next looking at it on the ship too long. A fellow from Pop Side, whose name was Spencer, I hadn't met him, came and handed me this message. He said, is your name, first name Lester? I said, yes. He said, well, let me put it for you. So I stopped long enough to read it, and I sort of shook my head. As you know, it's all kind of con games to separate a service man from his money. And I thought, something's going on here like that. So I just folded it, put it in my little pocket there in the place. But all day long, I was going to endure. All day long, the Lord didn't let me forget it. How did he get my name? Where in the world did he have any contact with me? So that just kept bugging me. So I got someone to take care of the evening dinner, and I said, well, I'll go over and see what this is all about. But I left all my money aboard except 25 cents for a water taxi. So I was there a little bit before 4, and after a while, amongst all those blue uniforms, I saw a civilian. And he was looking around. I thought, well, this must be the man. So I got up, went over to him, and I said, are you Trotman? Yes. You Spencer? Yes. And then he told me who he was and what it was all about. And he said, how'd you like to go home with me tonight to a chicken dinner? And you know my response. And he said, I called Lila after I sent that message, and she's prepared a chicken dinner for us. Remember that, Lila? So before long, we arrived at his home. A lovely time, lovely dinner. And then Doc said, let's go and have a little fellowship around the word. Fine. He had a Chevy, two-door coupe. We got in that car, wound our way up the hill there, and came to a place in the road that was wide enough for a car to pull out and park. And I learned later that this was Lover's Lane. That's why the police were there. But we had settled in there, was reading the scriptures off the reading, it turned on the little light above, and I was on the passenger side. All of a sudden there was a knock on the window right by me. And I looked up and here was a policeman with a big star. And he knocked me in, I rolled down the window. He what are you guys doing here? And one of the things that I always admired in Doug, he was always quick on the trigger. And he says, well, sir, we're reading the Bible. Is that all right? And you see amazement written all over his face. And there was a moment silence. Doug picked it up just like that. He says, well, he said, if you don't believe us, he told us that he was a guard at the school at the big laurel hedge, about 20 feet high there. And he told us that he was a guard for that school. And Doc said, well, if you don't believe us, you just go in and unlock one of those pool rooms, turn on the light, and we'll prove it to you. And so he said, okay. So he led us down into the school room, turned on the light, and Doc didn't deal with it. And the thing I guess that impressed me most about that whole thing was the Doc's knowledge of the word and his skill in using it. This fellow brought up all kinds of questions, and Doc didn't argue with him at all. And he had the ladder on his Bible, and he flipped that over many times right to the page. And he'd say, sir, did you read this? And then he'd bring up something else. And this happened for about 20 minutes. And finally, this fellow had nothing more to say. And so Doc pressed him then for a decision. And he said, well, not now. I'm not ready. So we went on our way up the path, and I was so amazed. I'd never seen anybody handle a Bible like that before. And I said to him, we walked out, and he talked up to me. And he said, no. I'd give a right arm if I could do that. And he said, oh, see, he was dating me. And he was really setting me up for something he had in mind. I'd already been prepared because of the experience on the ship. Fellas, you know, I want to take you ashore and get you into all kinds of troubles, and I wouldn't go. And this happened two or three times. And finally, this one fellow said, well, you don't go with us. You think you're too good for us? And I said, no, I don't think I'm too good for you, but and I'm a Christian and I don't do those things. We were in the compartment there, and there were the guys around. And he went out of yelling and says, hey, guys, come on over here. We've got a real live one. You know, and then it started. About six or seven of them. We're being getting quiet. And all these things that I didn't know anything about. And I felt so bad because I just felt I was letting the Lord down. And I got out of those situations as quickly as I could.
Almost a couple more words than I could say. That tape was made in 1983 at a reunion, and it's on Discipleship Library, the entire tape, 42 minutes. So he tells what went before and after, and I recommend you read it. There's several tapes that have the same title, called The West Virginia Gang, but this is the one identified as 1983. In 1985, we had Lester on again and made a videotape. And we've got the audio of that tape in the Discipleship Library. And Fred tells me that eventually the video will be available on the Discipleship Library, which you can listen to the 85 audio without the pictures in that. Now, in 83, let's see, Lester, he was born 2 years before I was. So 1383 is what, 70? So he was already 72 years old and apparently had one memory lapse, because the story up to that time had already been, when the policeman said to the guys, he said, "Where's the bottle?" Because this was during the days of Prohibition. And when two people were seen together in a car, they had a bottle. It wasn't necessarily that he wanted to enforce the law, but he wanted to sample, see how good it was. In fact, I read about this period of history where in Chicago, this report of a gangster said that he was killed and left a wife and 7 policemen to support. But according to the earlier version, before Lester put it on this one, why the policeman said, "Okay, where's the bottle?" And Dawson said, "We don't have a bottle. We have a Bible." So I prefer the earlier version before Les got to be 72 years old on this. Okay, well, I just wonder what's your appetite. And when somebody says, "Well, how are the navigators today compared with the original navigators?" Well, you can do the research. Make your own decision. Okay, Susan, you want to ask a question or two? Is that what you said you want to do next year?
I just want to ask you a few questions. What was your initial impression of Dawes the first time you saw him?
Well, I could almost read from that book there. I think I can read the paragraph on that, Dan.
We can find it for you if you want us to.
"From a build-up my friends had given me about Dawson, I expected to see a rugged Superman type indeed. I was introduced to a 120-pound man with small waist, slender ankles, and head that seemed large in proportion to his body. His heavy beard made him look like he needed to shave a few minutes after applying a razor to his slim, elongated face. Dawson grabbed my hand with a firm grip as his slender arm and bony hand could muster. His voice was higher pitched than most of the men I'd been associating with during my 15 months in the Navy, of which the last 9 had been aboard ship. The fact that he was a civilian and not too impressive with that was one strike against him in my book."
Well, since this is a birthday party, I was wondering how the navigators celebrated birthdays. Did you guys have birthday parties for each other?
Maybe you should ask me first if we had birthdays. I remember when I was in Korea, I found out a week later I'd had a birthday. I'd say that wasn't a big part of the life, no.
Mm-hmm. Well, this might be the only birthday party that Dawson Trotman has ever had, so... does anyone have any questions that they would like to ask Mr. Downing?
We tend to think, wow, things were so much more spiritual back then. Can you describe, were people really ashamed of being a Christian back in the 1930s? And secondly, how many chicken dinners did Lila prepare during that period?
That's what made the fleet navigators different. They were not ashamed. And compared to many other Christians, I guess they were, yeah. But, a battleship was a perfect laboratory because there's no downtime. You're a Christian from the time you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning to get up, how you react to that. I'm the observation, you know, all the time. And, I don't know. Quite a few chickens.
We'll take maybe 1 or 2 more questions if anyone has them.
Jim, when you stood watch, how long did it take you to get a verse memorized?
Will you repeat that? You heard his question.
Fred Krebs asked how long it took you to get a verse memorized when you were standing watch.
The kind of job I had, I couldn't memorize while I worked. Some people could. You know, it was pretty intense. However, 4 days after I became a Christian, John Dedrick and Ed Goodrich, you've seen them in that picture of the 4, came in the gun turret where I worked to do some follow-up. and they present the wheel. And while they were doing that, another sailor that I worked with seemed interested. So they abandoned me and began to talk to him. And everything he brought up, they had an answer for it. So when I saw how skillfully they handled the word, I said, where'd you learn all those verses? And they said, well, there's a memory course put out by Moody Bible Institute called Scripture Memory for Personal Evangelism. They showed me the list, 105 verses. You think there might have been some plagiarism later in that? But I looked over these verses and tried to categorize them in which to learn first. I couldn't see any more important than the other. So in a week-old Christian, I assigned myself a quota of 10 a day until I got all 105 of them. I didn't have to wait till I went on watch, Fred, to do that.
Are there any other questions? Well, thank you so much for coming out to speak to us today. I just have a few words to say, and then we can all have some cake and punch. In the history department, we are interested in recovering people's humanity.
Oh. Forget about the hangman's noose here.
Yeah, you're right.
People are not born to school of the figures. That's a problem with not the guy who got the cupcakes and fruit, and please check out our archives. Thank you.